Welcome to Best Band Never, a podcast hosted by me, Boris Milov.
And I'm Devin William Daniels.
On this show, we each pick a song, play it, and then discuss it.
So, Boris, in case the audience is wondering why they should care about our opinions on these songs or music in general, I'm Devin Daniels. I'm a musician currently living in Seoul, South Korea. I've played in a few bands, most recently Dead Channel, and I write about music for a couple websites, The Bomber Jacket and Indie Rock Cafe. And what about you, Boris?
I don't do any of that stuff, but I do talk to you about music a lot, and some of our conversations are actually occasionally worth, not money, obviously, but maybe perhaps, worth other people hearing about. So yeah,
perhaps your attention,
hypothetical
audience member.
I don't know. We both listen to a lot of music, very wide variety. So, you know, maybe
and
we
I
have
also,
something to say.
Also, we have very different taste, I feel. And I think part of what started this idea for the podcast is us trying to send songs to each other that we thought the other person would like, and always being wrong, and sort of trying to figure out each other's taste, and
figuring out why the other person doesn't like this song, because it's clearly the best song ever.
Exactly. So that's part of what I think we're going to be trying to uncover and unpack as we examine these artifacts is, you know, certain people obviously always think something's good or bad, but why is that? What's going on there? Beyond just the obvious, I like this, I don't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to have a theme each week. Do you want to talk about what our theme is this week, Boris?
Yeah, so because this is the first podcast, we decided that this week's theme will be firsts. In whatever sense of first, is it going to be the first album you ever heard, the first song you remember, you know, the first song you've cared about, something like that. And, so we each picked a song that somehow represents a first for us. And you'll hear those songs in a bit. The song I picked is Hey Ladies by the Beastie Boys, which is off their second album, not their first one. But I'll explain why I picked that for this show in a second here.
And I also picked, actually, a song off my band's second album, interestingly enough. But the first one I bought, I have the song Tired of Sex, the opening track off Weezer's Pinkerton, which, as
far
as I
know, at least it's the first song on the album.
It is the first song on the album, and I believe it was the first album I ever bought. It was either that or the one Vertical Horizon album, but no one wants to hear about that. So we will be discussing Pinkerton, and I'll probably go in a little into Weezer in general, but that's my starting off point for them. The first track on the second album, Pinkerton.
All right, but first we're going to listen to the song I picked, and that's Hey Ladies by the Beastie Boys.
The ladies, more time. Andy Bunker now. Hey, 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 ladies. Andy Bunker, you know.
So, Boris, where would you like to start with this one?
So, I guess I'll say why it's a first for me. I found this album on a CD rack at my uncle's house. He was always into, like, techno and hardcore and stuff and go to raves. And so when I was a little kid, he was this, like, epitome of cool music as far as I was concerned. And, you know, I knew vaguely who the Beastie Boys were, but I didn't really know anything about them. Or, you know, what I did know is what, like, the few tracks that the local rock station would play off of License to Ill, you know, which is not their most sophisticated music, musically or lyrically. So when I finally, like, found this album at my uncle's house and asked him if I could borrow it and listen to it, it was, like, the first, like, real music I'd ever heard, you know? Or at least that's what it felt to me when I was little. And some of the, like up until I listened to this album, hip-hop, like, I grew up in a suburb, so for me, hip-hop was this, like, weird, terrible, awful thing that nobody would ever listen to. And hearing, like, this album just, like, blew my mind with, like, the inventiveness of the rhymes and the weird sounds and stuff. And then, of course, I learned much later, too, that this is an important first, in a way, in that it's the first truly sample-based album out there that was, like, just nothing but samples the whole way through. And, I mean, obviously, people had been sampling things before then, but this album kind of marked the beginning of, like, the serious sample-based music.
I was looking at just on Wikipedia, and I noticed just the list of samples here. I mean, we could do an entire show just on songs sampled in this song. You've got Ballroom Blitz. You've got Jungle Boogie, Machine Gun by the Commodores, Hush by Deep Purple. It's quite the collection of samples just all on one song, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much happening here, you know. And I mean, like, reading a list of samples can, like, introduce you to just a world of music you'll never crawl out of.
Yeah. I enjoyed the little, like, cowbell break that keeps happening. I thought that was interesting. I'm not as nearly as well-versed in rap music as you are. I'm more of the indie rock guy, but you know, I do enjoy good rap music. I'm not a historian of the genre, but I found that a very distinct, this sort of the rhythmic break and just nothing but that cowbell happening. I thought was pretty cool, in especially coming from such a, I don't think you could do that now. If a song did something like that, I don't think people would react well to it. I don't know.
Yeah, it's definitely, like, definitely really feels like late 80s, early 90s sort of experimental thing before, you know, hip-hop became this multi-billion dollar industry.
Yeah, it reminds me of, like, I would draw a parallel to, like, early filmmaking, where some of the early filmmaking is much more experimental than a lot of the, you know, the things we think of as classic movies, mm-hmm. because it's a new medium and people are, they're willing to try, you know, just about anything because the rules of the medium or the genre haven't been developed yet. This definitely had that sort of feel to it of this kind of, it's strangely old and new at the same time.
Yeah.
Because it's got that classic kind of old school feel to it, but it's also got that experimentalism and that feeling that this could go anywhere. Whereas if you listen to the typical rap song on the radio now, that seems very... There's very few current rap artists that I listen to and I feel like they're opening new possibilities.
You know? Yeah, the thing of the Beastie Boys is they've always been, in their lyrical style has always been very conservative. It's this, you know, call and response, like, you know, dueling MCs sort of thing that Run DMC, you know, made popular. But their music has always been way more experimental. Their backbeats and stuff. I mean, they released an instrumental album, you know, which is one of my favorite albums, The In Sound from Way Out. So, and they just do all sorts of things with sound. And one of the things that immediately made me love this song and why I picked this one in particular, or one of the reasons I picked this one in particular, is there's the line where he says, "Educated, no, stupid, yup. And when I say stupid, I mean stupid." And then there's a record scratch. I mean, there's apparently a lyric there. It says in the lyrics, "And when I say stupid, I mean stupid fresh." But yeah. You can't hear anybody say fresh. You just hear a record scratch. And rhyming a word with a record scratch is just not something that, you know, like, happens in pop music.
Yeah.
So I was, certainly, you know, so, yeah, I was amazed by that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. But speaking of the lyrics, I mean, before, do you have anything you want to say about the song lyrically? I have a couple things I noticed.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, for one, I realize I have no idea who, like, half these people getting name-dropped are. Tom Cushman, I don't know who that is. Chuck Woolery.
Chuck Woolery was a game show host in the 70s and
80s. We're going to have to do some. But also, some of the... I don't know how I feel about some of these... similes. Words are flowing out just like the Grand Canyon. I'm not sure about that. Does the Grand Canyon really flow? I guess things flow into the Grand Canyon.
Well, the Colorado River flows through the Grand Canyon.
Yeah. And also the, I can't help but with the refrain of "Hey ladies," it just, I don't know if this is intentional, but to me, also with the delivery, the kind of accent, I don't know which one is which, but the guy that has the really kind of New York-y accent.
That doesn't narrow it down at all.
Yeah, it makes me think of Jerry Lewis.
Okay.
You know, and his, like, "Hey Lady" thing. Which I found kind of interesting in a, you know, the refrain to a popular rap song recalling Jerry Lewis. Is a little interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this, like, the this is before the Beastie Boys kind of acquired their social conscience, and so they're still singing about, you know, whereas there's a line, you know, lassoed her and
yeah, that was.
It is. I threw the lasso around the tallest one and dragged her to the crib. So not exactly, you know, progressive and forward-looking.
Yeah, and the following line, "I took off her moccasins and put on my bib."
It is, you gotta admit, that is a very evocative metaphor.
It is, but it's also a problematic one, for sure. And, I mean, you certainly, as you do in a lot of rap music, you see some problematic things here with the representation of women. You see that if you watch the music video as well, as I was just doing. Both like listeners and if we are fans of this song, how do you think we're supposed to reconcile the problematic nature of a song like this? Like, does it become okay because later they develop a social consciousness, or are we just accepting it as part of the genre? What's your perspective on this as a fan of the band?
I think in a lot of ways, this is a really lame defense and it's not meant as a defense, but it's a product of the time when, like, they were young guys in their 20s, you know, like, making lots of money and, like, playing around with 8-track recorders and stuff. And 4-track, I think, is what they were working with when they made this album. But, so I don't think they really were thinking about the lyrics that much. But I also think it helps that you can't understand a lot of the lyrics if you're not actually looking at them, because there's just there's too much going on with the music and the, like, you know, the dueling MC style, like, you know, makes it hard to kind of follow the thread of the lyrics.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's, you know, a little less bad, but it's certainly, but I mean, I think it's telling that the Beastie Boys later on distanced themselves from their earlier music.
Yes.
Not their music, but the way, you know, the kind of lyrics they wrote early on, you know, and tried very hard to, you know, write about, you know, more important things, or, you know, being a lot more careful in how they treat other people in their lyrics.
Yeah. And I sort of feel like, excuse the pun, but, like, rap music gets a bad rap in this sort of discussion, because while there is a lot of, you know, problematic, misogynist things happening in a lot of rap lyrics, I feel like it happens just as much in popular rock music. But it tends to be done in what is perceived to be a classier light, you know. It's and we'll see this when classy, we go on like, to
classy like cherry pie.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's more of a, well, the rap misogyny tends to be a little more aggressive, I guess you could say. It's still the sort of smooth talking, you know, creepiness of popular rock music is still equally problematic, and this is really, I think we make it out to be a rap problem, but it's really just a
the only difference is problem. The only difference is whether the girl is getting drunk on 40s or on Coors.
Yes, exactly. I recall the popular country hit, which I believe was entitled "Rain Is a Good Thing." The chorus goes, rain makes corn, corn makes whiskey, whiskey makes my baby get a little frisky. So, everybody's
there is the implication. There's the implication in that lyric, though, that it's, she's already his baby. So, you know.
But who is he to determine his ownership over his hypothetical whiskey drinking woman?
Fair enough.
How does he know her intent? But he's sort of connecting it to the cosmos. You know, it's all been like, it's rain. The rain itself
is part of the circle of life.
Yeah, it's the lifeblood that is going to result in him getting laid tonight. You know, so there's definitely a sort of in popular music as a whole, this sort of the inevitability of male conquest and the how that is an inherently good thing, you know, like.
Well, I mean, I think so much for so much of making music for young people is the pursuit of getting frisky.
Yes.
So I think there's a reason why so much popular music is about, you know, not even about love. Like, it used to be about love because you couldn't talk about sex.
Yes.
But, you know, once you could, then it just became about sex. You know, that's what, you know, young people are obsessed with. So why not write all your music about it?
And I can say, as someone who's been playing music since I was in eighth grade, if there's any kids out there, it doesn't work. Do something else. I've probably...
Become scientists.
Yeah, science is the new rock star, really, the scientist, because I've probably spent, I don't know how many thousands of dollars on musical equipment from Fender, and if there was any sort of guarantee that I was supposed to get laid as a result of any of that, then they owe me a lot of money back. But
that is definitely probably somewhere in the fine print of every you know, instruction manual for every guitar. It just says somewhere hidden in there, this will not get you laid.
Yes. I can say that is why I started playing guitar, though. And, like, I was trying to impress a girl in eighth grade, I believe. And so I think the good musicians are maybe the ones who, they like the Beastie Boys, they start with, you know, these very kind of, you know, low aims, but then at some point the music itself becomes its own end and you kind of move on from that. And you're like, oh, hey, this isn't just a means to try to impress girls, you know, but...
Yeah, if only Creed would get over there trying to impress girls' face, the music could really grow.
Yeah. But it works for Creed so well. You know, why would they stop? Let's see. Is there anything else you want to unpack in this one?
I know some of the rhymes that they used in this song, they've referenced specifically Vincent van Gogh, Go and Mail That Ear, is one that I know... they've talked about in documentaries and stuff as like lyrics that they have no idea where they came from. But I mean, that's another reason I picked the song is just because there's so many inventive rhymes throughout and so many just weird left field references all packed in this one song.
It almost recalls to me like a something like Desolation Row by Bob Dylan or something. Where there's all these different cultural figures are popping in. Vincent van Gogh is in there. The previously mentioned Tom Cushman is in there. Different cultural artifacts. Like the Coupe de Ville shows up. You know, it's kind of almost like a
Welcome Back Cotter.
Welcome Back Cotter's in there. It's almost like a museum of that moment in time, you know, and the culture of that time, all these things popping in without much rhyme or reason. Well, with lots of rhyme, but
not very much reason.
Not very much reason. I'm sure, like, we could do some sort of half-baked analysis where we, you know...
There is a website, the Notated Beastie Boys, somewhere out there. I'll post the link to it when I post this online, which goes through a bunch of their songs and, you know, pulls out every reference and I think provides links for a bunch of them. Hopefully it's still online.
Very cool.
Well, do you want to get to your song then?
Sure. Let's move on. I'm not necessarily done talking about the Beastie Boys and their place in rap music, but I kind of want to bring in Weezer into that discussion as well. So... let's jump into Tired of Sex by Weezer.
I'm tired.
All right, so tell me about this song, Devin.
All right, so, you know, this song for me, it's almost hard for me to even determine whether it's even a good song or not, because my feelings of nostalgia when I listen to this song are just so overwhelming, because, like I said, Pinkerton, I believe, is the first CD I ever actually bought. I can remember going to, like, the, I think it was the FYE at the local mall, which is, an experience as a whole is so foreign since no one buys CDs anymore, and purchasing this album, and I can remember listening to it with my headphones on my, like, portable CD player, because I didn't have any actual speakers at this point in life, and, like, singing along to this album, and not realizing how loud I was because I had the headphones on and being yelled at by my parents. And this was really it was a big moment for me, because up until now, I only knew music that was very, very mainstream, you know, things like what my sisters would listen to, your boy bands and whatnot. I knew of, like, the mainstream rock radio at the time, which was, you know, very focused on muscly dudes in, like, designer t-shirts and gelled up hair, which was an image of kind of male idolatry that just was so disconnected from my experience as this nerdy kid in the suburbs that just played video games all the time. Just didn't speak to my experience at all, nor did, like, the syncopated, perfect movements of a band like, NSYNC or the Backstreet Boys. So this was kind of my first exposure to, alternative rock. I was a little too, young to get into, like, Nirvana or something first. So this was kind of my Nirvana. And, you know,
this 1,000 Nirvana fans have just called for your blood.
To be fair, at least Nirvana wasn't together long enough to release the terrible, terrible albums that Weezer has released late in their career, including an album that just has the face of Hurley from Lost on the cover. It's just referred to as Hurley. But I still stand by the first two Weezer albums. This is the second one. The first one was much poppier, and that was actually the second album I ever bought, I believe. But this one was a little more dark. It had, listening to it now and listening to the, you know, the distorted guitars that are kind of low in the mix, I can kind of see how this would lead me into getting to, things like My Bloody Valentine or other more noisier Sonic Youth, noisier bands where that same guitar is just higher in the mix, and the vocals are a little lower. I can sort of see.
I was going to say the solo, you know, before the last verse, really, like, does not sound like something off an indie rock album. You know, it sounds a lot heavier and a lot, you know, screechier than you'd expect from a song with lyrics like this.
Yeah, and also a lot. I think a lot more. Technical, I want to say. You know, it's very well played. It's not sloppy. And that was kind of always the thing that distinguished Weezer in my mind, is while they were a lot of the indie rock world, you know, like bands like Pavement, who are my personal favorite, there's sort of this aesthetic of laziness and not necessarily being very good at guitar playing.
Punk aesthetic of thrash out the music
the punk, you know, was very into, you know, it thought amateurism was an inherently good thing, and that idea, while a lot of the ideas of punk have faded away, that idea has remained in alternative music, with few exceptions, really. A lot of, like, the great indie rock idols are not that good at their instruments. The guys from Television are an exception. Stephen Malcolm's from Pavement eventually became a very good guitar player on his solo work, but the earlier stuff is less technical. someone like Kevin Shields from My Bloody Valentine, you know, talks openly about how he couldn't really play guitar much, which led to him developing his particular kind of shoegazy, warbly strumming style. But Weezer were always very clean.
That's one thing that that we have in common as far as music is that we both like very proficiently played and very well produced music.
Yes.
Rather than, you know, the more, well, with the exception of the Mountain Goats, but they're an exception to just about everything in pop music.
Yes. So. Yes. But yeah, you know, the thing about, you know, starting with an album like this young is, you know, I really gained an appreciation for, you know, kind of the cleanness of the respect for the pop form that you see throughout this album. Even as it's getting angstier and noisier, it's really doing things in a well-produced way. There's not a lot left to chance on this album, musically.
Yeah, and that's one thing that definitely... So you asked earlier, or I should say you said earlier, that you weren't sure whether this was a good song or not. And I was going to say, well, no, it's kind of a dumb song. But then as I was listening to it, it struck me that in a song that can make a line like "Tonight, tonight it bleeds" not sound like the angstiest, most awful thing ever, it's got to be a pretty good song. And it is, because it's got that sort of like weird Beach Boys vibe of like expertly crafted melodies, you know, over very well played music. That can really sell a lot of things that more poorly, you know, composed music wouldn't be able to sell.
Yeah, and I feel like we were talking about, you know, the problematic lyrical histories of both rap and rock music earlier, and I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, how well can you sell it? 'Cause most lyrics are just really bad. And I think this is an example of, you know, I think these lyrics are kind of interesting as a cultural artifact. I would be hard-pressed to find anyone who would look at these lyrics and say, this is, you know, poetical, well-crafted verse, you know.
Yeah, Nick Drake, this isn't.
Yeah, exactly. Townes Van Zandt, need not apply. But when you... A lot of being a popular musician, you know, you can't be, if you want to be popular, you often can't be too poetical or profound, because you need to be direct. People need to understand what you're saying. So you need to be able to say something that's very direct, and being direct is always embarrassing, you know. If you've ever broken up with somebody, or asked someone out, or done anything in the arena of romance, you know, no one ever wants to be direct.
I haven't done any of those things, so have to explain it to me step by step.
Well, you see, Boris, when a man loves a woman...
Oh, God, no, too much. You're being too direct.
Okay. I'm sorry. You know, I'll make you a mixtape about it.
Oh, but, yes.
You know, this is a stupid song. It's about how the guy is... There's not really much to unpack here. He's tired of having sex. You know,
which the Beastie Boys notably aren't.
they are not. And he's sort of, but it's kind of interesting because he's confronting this, this thing that all music pretty much is about, we're saying, you know, all popular music more or less is about trying to get sex, right? And then here we have a guy who has decided he's reached that mountaintop and he's become kind of, you know, he's bored with it, so to speak. Not a problem I can relate to, but nonetheless, he name drops these women, and I think this is interesting because if you look at Pinkerton as a whole, the name Pinkerton comes from the opera Madama Butterfly, I believe it's called. Yeah, or just Madame Butterfly, excuse me, which is kind of one of the quintessential artistic examples of Asian fetishism, or yellow fever, as we might call it. It's you know, about
as expressed in "Hey Ladies" by "Woke Up in the Morning at the Wonton Ho."
Exactly. You know, this is something we see throughout the culture of white man, you know, lusting after Asian woman. And as a guy who's currently living in South Korea, you know, this is right in my wheelhouse. But Pinkerton is largely dealing with these themes of a white rock musician kind of confronting more general the kind of assholishness of a character like B.F. Pinkerton from Madam Butterfly, but the particular Asian fetishism is undeniably there. If you look at the cover to the album, it's taken from a piece of Japanese art. There's later songs on the album, like El Scorcho has the line, "God damn you half Japanese girls," and references Chocho San, the name of the character from Madam Butterfly. There's a song called Across the Sea, which was literally written in response to a letter that Rivers Cuomo received from a Japanese fan while he was at Harvard University. So I kind of view as the first track, I kind of view Tired of Sex as his not necessarily being tired of sex, but being tired of white sex, being tired of sex with people with names like Denise and Therese and or Therese and Louise. You know, I think in addition to being really forced rhymes by picking those names, the names are also notably, you know,
white girl names.
And then later he's going on to, you know, writing a love ode to a Japanese girl. So I don't think it's that he's tired of sex. Again, I think it's this particular brand of Western rock groupie-based white person, suburban, all those sort of, you know.
He's tired of sex with the kind of girls that he gets to have sex with.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, so it's not the act itself. It's, you know, what undoes a great many people is they want variety. And this is sort of him.
There's an interesting parallel here with the early on Paul's Boutique, the album that Hey Ladies is off of. There's a song that it's just one of the guys just saying, like, listing off a country where girls are from and just basically saying, hey, like it just goes like Jamaican girls, you know, whatever, African girls, Japanese girls. And just lists off a bunch of, I think it's the first or second track on the album. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it parallels interestingly with the themes of Pinkerton and of this mm-hmm. song.
Yeah, and I think that ends up really being the most problematic part of this of all, is it's not just that we're being misogynistic, it's not just that we're kind of turning the women into sexual objects. We're not even recognizing them so much as people as much as nationalities or traits, you know, mm-hmm. things we want to check off the list. Like, you know, have I made it with a Japanese girl? Check, you know, check, such. That's where it gets really, I think, concerning. And,
I think there's another way to look at it. And especially with the Beastie Boys, because they are from Brooklyn, from New York, mm. you know, they're from, like, the most, like, multicultural city in the world, you know. Well, I mean, I don't know exactly to what extent that's true, but they definitely have seen their share of people from all over the world. Mm-hmm. So when a group like the Beastie Boys, you know, talks about people from different places, they might very well be saying that because they have dated a Jamaican girl mm-hmm. and a Japanese yeah. girl and a, you know, whatever, a Russian girl, and I'm sure plenty of Jewish girls, given that it's the Beastie Boys. Mm-hmm. But I guess I don't know. Weezer, in my head, is very much a suburb band, not a
that's
city
certainly
band.
That's certainly the aesthetic they have, and that's certainly the lyrical content suggests that. I am not too well versed in the autobiographical, the biographical history of the individuals, particularly Rivers Cuomo, the front man. But according to Roland Barthes, we don't need to worry about that anyway. So, I definitely feel, at least within the character of the narrator of this Pinkerton album, is definitely someone who, you know, has only had this very suburban, very white, sexual experience. And to him, it's, you know, he's never even met the Japanese girl in the song Across the Sea. It's just it's just words on a page. It's just a letter, but it's just this, the idea of the exotic, you know,
imbued with this, faraway mystique that.
Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, as, again, someone who is living in Seoul, South Korea right now, there are a lot of guys who come here with the aim of finding an Asian wife. It's still a very, very real thing. Like, I have had people consult me asking, like, if they come here, will they be able to find a Korean girlfriend? And I'm like, well, I'm here with my girlfriend of 6 years, so I'm like, I don't know.
I have definitely, I was looking at going to work in South Korea for a while, and one of my friends who lived there for a long time, first thing she said to me when she heard was, oh good, you'll find yourself a nice Korean wife.
Well, I do understand that, at least certain Korean women are actively interested in an American husband. Because Korean society is still very Confucian, but, and I'll tell you, I see guys that are really outpunning their coverage, if you know what I mean, walking on the street, like, balding, mid-30s, kind of chubby guy with, very beautiful ladies, so, you know, I can't necessarily blame them, but it does reach a certain level of creepiness as well.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when people are coming here with that specific intent.
Which I guess, is part of what Madame Butterfly is all about.
Yeah, and I've never actually, like, seen the opera performed or anything, but my understanding is there's a general of some sorts or a naval officer, Pinkerton, and he rents a house in Japan. He's there for his job and takes a Japanese wife, and all along has the intention of just divorcing her once he finds an American wife, because apparently the Japanese divorce laws are easy to navigate. And then some stuff happens. I'm not really sure exactly what the middle of the opera is, but it culminates in him realizing he truly loves the Japanese woman, but then, too late, he finds that she has cut her throat, with her father's harakiri knife, is what, Wikipedia is telling me. Actually, I'm just gonna read this sentence verbatim, because this is pretty loaded. Quote, she places I guess they've had a son at some point. She places a small American flag into the son's hands, and goes behind a screen, cutting her throat with her father's harakiri knife. Pinkerton rushes in. He is too late. That's a pretty loaded image there.
No kidding.
Putting the American flag in the half Japanese son's hands and. Man. So, you know, obviously this album is being inspired by problematic material. And I don't think Rivers Cuomo is unaware of that either. He talks in interviews about wanting to, on this album, confront his inner Pinkerton, which he is kind of supposed to be his inner asshole of sorts.
And the way I understand it, he's actually kind of disowned, like, he said that he wouldn't have made this album in retrospect, right?
I'm not sure, but I would not be surprised.
I think I read that, like, he kind of regrets putting all the things he put on this album out there for people to see.
Mm-hmm. But then again, it also produced easily one of Weezer's best two albums, and their material since then has not been good, so maybe...
Well, is the song with Buddy Holly off one of these two?
That's from the first album.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the first album, which is self-titled, but often called the Blue Album, because they've released three self-titled albums.
Which still confuses and infuriates me.
Yeah, you're just trying to be cute at that point, you know? When it's just two, I'm like, okay, that's a little funny. But when you release the third one, now you're just being a jerk. But it doesn't matter, because you only need to have the first two Weezer albums.
Well, there you go.
And,
life tip, listeners.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it's problematic music. It's not necessarily, fantastic, all-time great music, but it's well-crafted, it's, power pop, done well, and, you know, I still stand by those records, even though you know, it's a little embarrassing to think I was once, like, in seventh grade singing along to a song with lyrics like, "Tonight I'm down on my knees, tonight I'm begging you please, oh why can't I be making love come true?" I do remember thinking that was really clever, though, when I was a kid. "Why can't I be making love come true?" I thought that was great.
The height of wit.
Yeah, but, you know, what are you gonna do? It's suburban rock, really at its finest and most honest, in a way. Because a lot of the rock music to come out of the suburbs is obsessed with themes that has nothing to do with it. You know, like I look at a lot of the indie folk that's coming out right now, where like some dude from outside of Denver, who had a really nice upbringing, is singing about, you know, like the Dust Bowl and, you know, trying to get the horse across the river. And, you know,
that can certainly be fun, but honest is not the first word that comes to mind.
Yes. You know, here's a guy that's really, you know, male suburban white experience is not necessarily something to be proud of. You know, I grew up in that, and it was really a big waste of time in retrospect. I didn't really do anything of worth. I guess I learned a little guitar. That's like the best thing I can say. I didn't really develop any meaningful relationships or learn much about the world or read any good books or anything. I just played video games and guitar and, you know, hung out in the basement. But this is this band is presenting a real depiction of that. And, you know, perhaps that's worth having in a limited dose, at least.
So you said you had a few more things to say about the Beastie Boys song, and I'm wondering what thoughts you have that, you know, maybe connected back to this song, or, you know, just in general, like what connections you see between the two songs they picked.
Well, I see a lot of connection. I guess they both kind of, and our experiences with confronting these two songs, I find very similar in that, you know, we're kind of both growing up in this very suburban experience, and then we are finding these two songs that sort of are breaking through our musical experience up to that point. But I think it's interesting the different ways they do, because for me, Weezer is breaking through that by presenting something that to me was like, you know, a depiction of myself. You know, like, Rivers Cuomo had the nerdy glasses and the short brown hair and the outfit. You know, he was like the rock star I could be. Mm-hmm. I'm curious what your experience, because it seems to me that it's your experience with the Beastie Boys is more that it's bringing something from outside the suburban world and it's crashing into that for you. Would you say that's accurate?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's like I said before, you know, rap music was this really foreign thing where it's like, oh, I don't listen to rap music. and of course, the first, like, rap music I did listen to was by a bunch of white guys, but, you know, baby steps. It took me a really long time before I found any musicians like I could identify with, but I'm a pretty weird guy anyway, so there's not a lot of people I identify with. I think the Beastie Boys had much less of a impact on me as far as like how I saw myself, but rather it affected how I saw like music as a whole, of like what music could be and what wasn't worth listening to. And I think if I hadn't, you know, listened to this album when I was a lot younger, I would have been a lot less willing to, you know, entertain a lot of other styles of music, because back in like junior high and, you know, beginning of high school, when I, you know, was like before I started to listen to this album, before I kind of got more adventures, I was listening to mostly like top 40 music, you know, like that everybody else was. And it wasn't until later that I actually started listening to, you know, more rock and more technical music. And, you know, it wasn't until college that I really got into a big variety of music. But, you know, there was always, you know, this sort of, touch point for me of this album and these, like this song in particular with the really clever things it did, which I could always say, oh yeah, there's, you know, I do listen to weird music. I do listen to, you know, stuff that, and like I said, the radio would play songs off of License to Ill, but I never liked the album. You know, I think it's a really kind of poor, you know, freshman effort.
That's the first album, right?
Yeah. That's their first album, which was then completely surpassed, you know, musically, if not lyrically necessarily, by the second album, opened the door to my willingness to listen to all sorts of other music that I would have never considered otherwise.
Yeah, and I think that's really the classic quintessential story that's been told, you know, millions of times over. In songs themselves, like if you listen to a song like Rock and Roll by the Velvet Underground, the line, "My life was saved by rock and roll," about hearing it for the first time on the radio, that's one of the true, truly romantic experiences of youth, is that, you know, that first spark of the idea that music can be something more than what it had been up to that point for you, than just what you're hearing on, you know, Casey Kasem. And I think both of these songs very much capture that for us. If anyone actually listens to this, I'd be curious to hear what songs did that for you, because I think it's an interesting exercise. All right, so for our last bit before we say goodbye, Boris and I, you know, the songs we pick to discuss during the podcast are ultimately what songs we find most interesting to talk about, not always necessarily the best songs. So for the last segment, we're each going to recommend something that's just really good, something we've been listening to lately or that is somehow apropos to bring up. So I would like to recommend the album Gentlemen by the band The Afghan Whigs. This album just turned 20 years old a few days ago on October 5th, so I've been listening to it a lot, and it's really, I think, one of my favorite albums to come out of the 90s alternative rock explosion, but also one of the most forgotten, because I feel The Afghan Whigs kind of were in this in-between place where they weren't really grunge, and they weren't really indie rock. And they were also influenced by R&B music a lot. So they were kind of this unique group that didn't fit into a lot of the preconceived categories of alternative music at the time. And I don't know a lot of people that like them that much, but I saw them last year. They played one of the best shows I've ever seen, and this album is excellent, so I highly recommend everyone give it a try. Boris, what did you want to recommend?
So, like I said earlier, you know, we're both really interested in, you know, technically well-played music, and that has gotten to kind of an extreme for me lately, in that I've been listening to a lot of math rock, which is like metal if you don't like metal. So there's a band I've been listening to lately, speaking of problematic things, called You Slut! Exclamation point.
Oh my.
But despite the silly name, they have absolutely fantastic albums, the first of which came out in 2007, is called Critical Meat. M-E-A-T. Critical Meat. And it's an instrumental album, but it's just super technical, weird time signatures, great guitars, great drums. So, you know, for a lot of people, it might just end up being boring, but if you like following along to the music, it's a fantastic album.
Sounds great. I'm definitely going to check it out. This is not something I've heard of. So I have the Bandcamp up right now, youslut.bandcamp.com. You can buy this album for only $3.49. So everyone should get out there and give it a try.
I should do that since I downloaded it completely legally. Much like all of the music on this podcast appears.
That is not possible. You're not. That's can't be done. I don't know what you're talking about. I guess the government is shut down right now, so we
go to town, listeners.
We can. We have a little more freedom. How are things back home with no government? Are you doing okay? Are the rations being delivered?
Well, no, they're actually being carried off mostly by winged demons.
Oh no!
So yeah, the trucks aren't really getting through.
Oh,
but hey, you know, if we can just stop people getting health care, everything will be better.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm here in South Korea where we have a single payer system. All my medicine is really cheap. Doctor visits really cheap. Taxes low. It's terrible. It's terrible.
Can't imagine how you live.
It's awful. I've been doing my best to close the national parks until something is done about it, but I'm only one man, and I don't speak Korean, so
do your best.
It hasn't been going well. It hasn't been going well, but. Good luck. Hopefully by the time I return to America in March of 2014, there is a government.
I don't know. We're doing pretty well with that one so far. So.
Yeah, I hear Denver fronted the cost of opening the national parks back up within their state. So.
There you go.
Yeah, that's good. So much for those cushy government jobs. Everybody's furloughed. It's a dark time. I need to watch some daily shows because I have no idea what's going on, actually.
Well, you go do that.
All right.
And I'm going to go to bed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we should note that we record this with a 13-hour, a 14-hour time difference because Boris is over in Minneapolis. So
Central
what
time.
It is now 2 a.m. for you?
Yep.
Yeah, it's 4 p.m. for me, so I'm going to go... go out there and seize the day. Be somebody. You get some sleep. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Have a good night.
This has been Best Band Never.
Goddamn you, half Japanese girls. Do it to me every time. All the redheads said you shred the cello. And I'm jello, baby. I'm the epitome, a public enemy. Why you wanna go and do me like that? Come down on the street and dance with me. I'm alive.